like I'm an awfully gamble for you.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Stuff that dreams are made of.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Hello and welcome to Front Row Classics, a production of the Front Row Network of Shows, where we take a look at some of the greatest films ever made. And here's your host, Brandon Davis.
And hello to everybody out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network with Front Row Classics with NPR Illinois Community Voices. I'm your host, Brandon Davis. And we are in the middle of MonsterCast. It's our busiest month of the year here at the Front Row Network. And here at Front Row Classics, we pay tribute to the movies that you have to have. Otherwise, there would be no MonsterCast. These are the original monster movies from the golden age of Hollywood. And we are talking about Frankenstein from 1931. Really, only second to Dracula being the original monster movie. This is number two in the series. So we are we're talking about what started it from the very beginning. And I have with me here my co-host, Eric Flick. How's it going, Eric?
It's going really well, Brandon. And how about yourself today?
Not too bad. We were talking beforehand, enjoying the fall weather, trying to be outside as much as possible.
Mm-hmm, indeed.
And also joining us again this month is Allison Means. How's it going, Allison?
Oh, pretty good. Hanging in there.
Oh, man. Well, we've made it to the fall. We are in the last quarter of 2020, so hopefully
we'll make racing. It. Racing towards 2021.
We are racing. I tell you, it's gone by fast for such what seems like such a long year. I can't believe we're in October already.
Yeah.
But
things from the spring feel like a lifetime ago. So much has happened.
They do. So we are we're talking about Frankenstein from 1931, and I actually want to start here. This movie opens with a strange introduction that not many movies open with, and actually, thanks to Wikipedia, I provided with the actual word for word, so I'm just going to say it real quick. How do you do? Mr. Carl Limley feels it would be a little unkind to present this picture without just a word of friendly warning. We are about to unfold the story of Frankenstein, a man of science who sought to create a man after his own image without reckoning upon God. This is one of the strangest tales ever told. It deals with the two great mysteries of creation, life and death. I think it will thrill you. It may shock you. It may even horrify you. So if any of you feel that you do not care to subject your nerves to such a strain, now's your chance to, well, we warned you.
Well done.
And so the world was introduced to the Frankenstein monster. We often refer to the monster as Frankenstein, although that's not really the case. It's Frankenstein's monster.
Yes.
So Allison, we'll start with you here. What are your first impressions of the original Frankenstein?
I thought for 1931 it was really gorgeous. I mean, I was watching with my husband, and he went, "This is, like, good cinematography." I said, yeah, it is lovely.
This movie will be 90 years old next year.
Wild. It's wild to think that, because it is done well. And there are some things that are like, hold on. But they did a really nice job of, you know, pulling it all together into something cohesive that makes you want to keep watching it even now, 90 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Eric?
Yeah, and that little opening is, no movies were introduced that way, and that's such a big risk. It's basically telling the audience, hey, we're going to try to creep you out here. And if they aren't successful in doing that, you know, you've set yourself up for failure. This movie takes risks a lot of different places, though.
Yeah.
And for the most part, it pays off all the way through. And I think that putting it in the perspective that this thing's 90 years old, too, you're like, boy, they really went out on a limb on some of these things. They didn't have access to blue screen green screen technology or the makeup that we've got in the modern movie world. So really a fun rewatch when you put it in the context of how old this movie is.
Eric, you and I talked about Dracula at the same time last year, and like we said, it doesn't even feel like a year, but this came out in the same year, and we mentioned before Dracula was the Valentine's release of that year.
What a weird choice.
And Frankenstein was the Thanksgiving release that year.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating because in just a few months' time, it's amazing. Dracula was such a success. This movie has a much higher budget, you can tell, than what Dracula had. Dracula was so stark looking, which, you know, suited it well. But it's amazing how much further, you know, just a little bit of money went, you know, and Universal was a studio that was hurting at the time. And if it wasn't for these two movies, you know, there might not be a Universal Studios today. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's really, really amazing that, you know, the monster craze caught on because people were looking for escapism during the Depression.
Yeah. And to think that this movie was just 6 months after Dracula. I mean, you couldn't get something greenlit in that amount of time these days.
Right.
So not only did they say, yeah, we're going to do this. And not only did they kind of pull a weird concept out of the archives. Now, I guess similar to Dracula, the Frankenstein story had been told on stage several different times and in different forms. But the fact that they did that and did that with such a larger budget, saying, okay, monster movies, we're all in. And to put that money into something like this, it's another risk that they took that pays off.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And using unknown actors in these roles, there really aren't stars in any of these movies. You know, it's not until you get to, you know, the later even B movies where they use bigger names or whatever. And it's really phenomenal. And we'll talk about the cast here in a second. But you mentioned it, Allison. It doesn't look too dated. And and James Whale, the director, who we'll also talk about, he defined what we, you know, think of when we think of a mad scientist laboratory, when we think of, you know, all of this stuff didn't exist before 1931. And it's, you know, tropes that we think of now, but you know, this came from Mary Shelley's novel, which is very different. Mary Shelley's novel, because you went to LCU with me and I read it in a class. Yep. And
I read it in high school as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did as well.
And it's really a morality play, but Universal, because of the success of Dracula, played up the monster element of it, which, you know, thank goodness they did, because otherwise I don't think Mary Shelley's vision on screen would have worked too well.
Yeah.
But saying that, there's the film that came out in the early 90s with Robert De Niro playing the Frankenstein monster, which is a true adaptation of the book. I think that movie probably doesn't give the credit that it deserves.
Pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, it owes everything to this movie. And, you know, being true to the book, it doesn't have the same monster design that the 1931 Frankenstein does. But another good movie to go check out in October here while things are creepy.
Yes. And if you really, really desperately want to see another interesting adaptation of it, there is the stage version of this that Benedict Cumberbatch plays the monster.
I think so.
It's really interesting. It's a really, really interesting stage adaptation. I think I found it on YouTube in its entirety. So
what got me about the movie this time as well is you can't pinpoint the time or place, because in the beginning,
yes,
it looks like you're in like a 19th century village, and then all of a sudden you're in a modern classroom, and then you're in like Eastern European village, and you know, and then there's gadgetry, and you can't pinpoint any time or place with this, and I think that helps it as well, because you know
it kind of removes it from time. You're like, when is this? Where is this?
Why do you think that's a conscious choice? I mean, you've got in sort of the opening scene, when we get past that preamble that the individual does at the beginning that you read there, Brandon, we go to a cemetery, and then you've got these sort of religious figures in this garb. And what I couldn't tell is, was this a conscious choice to make it ambiguous that we don't know what time it is, or was this what rural sort of Europe, Germany looked like in that time period in the early 30s? I mean, you're talking about a time that's 90 years ago where I could believe that that is what that area looked like.
Yeah, I can see that. Although, but it is kind of jarring when you go from that first sequence when Frankenstein and Fritz are, you know, in the graveyard, and, you know, Fitz looks like he's walked into another world when he sneaks into that classroom, though. So I don't know. It's interesting because, and of course Mel Brooks plays that up in Young Frankenstein too, which we can talk about some of the references to that later. But yeah, I don't, even if that was what 1931 and that part of Europe looked like, it's still...
But there were also, like, no telephones.
Yeah.
Which in, you know, these were upper-class people that we're talking about. The village might not have had a telephone, but, like, surely they would have in 1931.
Yeah. It's really interesting. Yeah, you can't pinpoint it, which I think even if that's what the world was like, it certainly makes it feel fairy tale-ish today, I think. You know, I think maybe that's improved over time even. So let's get into the cast. And even though he's fourth billed and he's a question mark in the opening titles, we'll give credit where credit is due to Boris Karloff as Frankenstein's monster. And I'm always amazed when I see this, because I'm sure in the script, you know, he's not given ton of what to do. You know, it's just probably basically blocking, but he created a full-fledged sympathetic character out of this monster. And he's absolutely brilliant. And, you know, part of that's the makeup too, which we'll talk about. But yeah, Karloff, you know, for being this unknown actor, he really went all out and, you know, created this image that people have imitated for 90 years now, almost a century. It's pretty amazing. Allison, what's your thought on Karloff?
It's absolutely incredible to look at what he is given script-wise, which is grunts and moans and screams, and to look at the extreme makeup and costuming that he's given, which would be a challenge to emote through in a way that doesn't come off as over, you know, like chewing the scenery. He's incredibly sympathetic. You really, when he is afraid, when they've, you know, Fitz is in there with the fire, and I mean, there is real terror on his face. He really does some incredible work. And, you know, if you look into it, he, like, developed the makeup with the makeup artist. He, like, took out some teeth. He had a partial. He, like, took it out and sucked his cheek in. And, like, I mean, I think there's a reason that it's stuck the way it did in our cultural understanding of what Frankenstein is, because it's an incredible performance.
Yeah, Eric?
Yeah, I want to echo that. I mean, the physicality that this guy put together to separate him from everyone else in the cast is just amazing. And if I were to stick my arms out sort of rigidly and hike my shoulders up, you know who I'm trying to be. And it's because of this movie, you know, and if I lock my knees and do sort of a shuffly walk, you know what Frankenstein looks like, because of this movie. He's fighting with people too. I mean, there's a whole lot of physicality that goes on. People are jumping on his back. Mm-hmm. This guy was in his 40s at the time too. And he was a physically imposing individual, but to do all this stuff that physically in his 40s is incredible. And then he had lifelong problems with arthritis as well. So you know that he threw himself into this work, and it shows up on the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what always astonishes me too is I can't imagine the resilience that Boris Karloff had, because you know that makeup was not fun, because makeup was not advanced in 1931.
Oh,
so
it would have all been thick oil-based
chemical, yeah,
pancake makeup, a grease paint.
Yeah, but yeah. And you're right, he did have a bridge on the side of it, which he took out and was able to sink his cheek in, which helped as well. But yeah, and then also he insisted, he thought the original makeup looked too alive, and so they created those heavier eyelids where he could only kind of peek out halfway, which made him look sort of half dead, and that really helped too. But yeah, and to give credit to Jack Pierce, who did the makeup and did the makeup for most of these monster movies. He also created the look for Lon Chaney and the Wolfman, and of course had to glue all that yak hair to poor Lon Chaney. Just incredible. And yeah, I think I read 3.5 hours in the makeup chair that Karloff would have to spend, and then almost the same amount of time to get it taken off. And
yeah, and that stuff does not come off easily, prosthetics especially.
And also he was wearing, they said his costume was not pleasant because it was all black and heavy boots, and they were shooting in August. And especially when they would go outside, like those scenes, like with him and the little girl outside, they said that was almost a 24-hour workday for him.
Wow.
So I can't even imagine. But when it's early in your career and you're wanting to get somewhere, I guess you do that. But
except Eric, for your art, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and Eric, you and I were talking before the podcast, and we could have had Bela Lugosi as Frankenstein.
Yeah, that would be weird.
It would have been weird. Although we do get Bela Lugosi as the monster in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman about 10 years later. I think everybody got a chance to play Frankenstein at some point. Because I think Lon Chaney Jr. played him as well in one movie. But
Brandon, yeah. the reason he didn't was because he wanted a little bit more meat to the part. He thought the monster should be able to speak and have a sort of pathos, if you will, that, you know, this was a much more tragic character. Maybe a bad call on his part, because you see that with the performance that Boris Karloff gives without having the words. Yeah. So, you know, this great actor, trained stage actor, Bela Lugosi, who just came off the big success, says, "I can't do it." It makes it even more impressive that Boris Karloff can step in and say, "I'll do it, and I'll do it with this amazing physicality." And now you've got this second monster movie that, you know, if Dracula's 1A, this is 1B in my book. You know, they don't really get better than these two.
Well, and this movie had a different director to begin with too, a guy by the name of Robert Flory, and he wanted it to be really German expressionistic type look. And so Lugosi, I think, was part of the package. And then when they were having issues with Lugosi, they threw both him and Flory out. And James Whale had just come over from Britain, and they were trying to entice him. And so the James Whale basically had pretty much creative control over this. So, and you can tell, because it really, there are things that you didn't see in 1931 that he's doing with the camera. And yeah, really fascinating. But yeah, back to Karloff though. By all accounts, and there's a nice little documentary on the Blu-ray I have where his daughter is talking, and she said, you know, most of the guys who play monsters or villains in movies are usually the nicest people in real life. And she said, her dad was the antithesis of, you know, the parts he played, because he was a well-read, you know, very quietly spoken English gentleman, and but just excelled at playing these kind of parts. But she said there was also something very childlike about him. And really, you know, unlike Dracula, who is a predator and is pure evil, Frankenstein, you know, he's a sympathetic character. He didn't ask to be created.
Right. He's sort of like a tabula rasa. Like, there's nothing. That's, you know, he can't speak. He doesn't know what anything is. It's like a baby.
Yeah.
And that childlike, it in the truest sense of like what it is like to have a teeny tiny child who does not understand the world comes through. But, you know, as a giant man, it would be very frightening.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Eric, any other thoughts on Karloff?
Yeah, and I think you mentioned it there briefly, Brandon, but it may surprise some listeners to know that Boris Karloff wasn't Boris Karloff. You know, his name, his given name is William Henry Pratt. He was an Englishman who came to Canada to study the arts and bounced around, you know, the community theater circuits for a long time before landing this part. Gets known for these monster movies, but had taken this name, Boris Karloff, even before that, which is really just kind of serendipitous, you know, that he takes what I would think, and maybe it's now because we associate it with these monster movies, but this more Slavic, Russian-sounding name is a little more sinister than William Pratt, you know, and maybe that's just my white Midwestern sensibilities, but that's who the guy was this proper Englishman, and you know, didn't have, wasn't Russian, didn't have a Russian accent, anything like that. Just a nice guy and a good actor.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. And I mean, just incredible. And what I love about Karloff is he, unlike Lugosi, he broke out of the monster mold. I mean, he always was kind of paying tribute to him. I would love to have seen him on stage in Arsenic and Old Lace, because I heard that was brilliant.
I can only imagine. And I love Arsenic and Old Lace so much. Brandon and I were in a production of it together in college. It's
so much fun.
Such a great show. And it would have been so amazing to watch that with all of their, he looks like Boris Karloff.
Yeah. It was meta before there was such a thing as meta.
Right.
And then of course he also, you know, has an imprint on Christmas, cause he's the narrator of How the Grinch Stole Christmas. So yeah. Karloff just sort of had his hands in everything. And yeah, it's really, really, really fantastic career. And a performance for the ages. Let's talk about though, Henry Frankenstein, the creator of the monster, Colin Clive, who sadly did not have a long career because he only died a few years after this. And a really strange performance. And we talked about this, Eric, with Dracula. This is 1931. We are only 4 years into talkies. And so a lot of these actors are stage actors. Movie technique is not a thing yet. We're 20 years away. We're 20 years away from Brando, and we're
still acting to the balconies.
And even just a decade, you know, people like Spencer Tracy and Gary Cooper, they would you know, master the subtlety of film acting, but these people, you know, they're still acting to the balcony even though they're in front of a camera. But I think it works for the character of Henry Frankenstein because he's supposed to be a little crazy. And Colin Clive, man, he's not always likable. As you move toward the anti-sympathetic, but yeah, Eric, what are your thoughts of Colin Clive's Henry Frankenstein?
Yeah, but you need to have sort of that big personality and that big presence. He, his mission is to play God.
Yeah.
So it fits his character.
He says it too.
He does.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll talk about that a little bit more. Yeah. But the other thing that he famously says is, it's alive. And delivered in such a way that is now an iconic scene in and of itself.
Yeah.
You know, you don't even see the monster in that. He's covered by a sheet. It's this actor as Dr. Frankenstein delivering that is one of the most memorable pieces of this movie. So good performance. He brings it down too. You know, he's a little more subtle when he goes the monster's loose and he goes and decides that he's actually going to marry his fiance. So
after he locks her in a room, I have things to say.
I'll let you pick it up from there. Cause I think he gives you what you want in this movie. Mm-hmm. And the stage training probably did right by him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He definitely, he doesn't play, you know, white hat or like pure villainous. He's a very complicated three-dimensional character. I think he does a really nice job with that, especially considering, like, source material-wise, this character is very different from Victor Frankenstein in the novel, like, already has a different name, and is very, very, very different, where, you know, your source background material would be like, I write, he's like, I'm gonna kill him. I gotta kill him. And I'm gonna hunt him across the world. Here he's like, no, well, I'll lock him up. Well, okay, I'll go get married. He's locked up. It's okay. like, and then it's, yeah, it's, it takes a very, very different turn as far as their struggle with each other. And I think that, yeah, he does a nice job balancing that, because it would be very easy to play as just total villain. Mm-hmm. You know, because that's one of the things with the novel is, who is the monster?
Yeah.
Right? That's one of your big themes. Mm-hmm. Was the monster, the creature, really the monster?
So let me get your thoughts on, because they obviously took the script and they said, okay, here's some source material. We're going to kind of throw that aside, and we're going to make the movie the way that we want to make it. Henry Frankenstein, the doctor, has the opportunity to kill the monster a couple of different times. But especially after he discovers that his assistant has been murdered, they choose not to let that happen. Why do they do that and make that choice here? And I guess it just fits with the rest of the story. And my thought is it because he's scared of the monster, or is it because he's proud of his creation?
I would say it's partly, you know, that proud of his creation, but also you see him kind of struggle with the ethical dilemma of, yes, he is a murderer, but am I?
Which is insane. This guy who digs up dead bodies and steals brains.
But now he's like,
it works.
Can I kill this person? Because at this point, they've established, like, they've seen him react to things. They've seen he's got emotional, you know, he's got emotions. He's got feelings. Can you kill him?
Yeah.
Even though he's done something terrible, can you do something terrible too?
Yeah, and there's still good intentions in him, and that little monologue he gives to Dr. Walden, you know, before the monster's revealed, where he's, you know, talking about, you know, aren't you curious to see what's beyond the stars and the clouds and all that kind of stuff, which apparently wasn't in the shooting script. And a lot of people credit James Whale for that, because he said that he wanted to add that little bit of character development in there. But yeah, like, I think because it's 1931, because it's the Depression, you know, the filmmakers didn't necessarily want to dig that deep into the morality play aspect of Shelley's novel. So I think they really, they wanted, you know, the light and the shade, the light and the dark to be a little more, you know, telling than it probably would be, you know, had it been made, you know, say in the 70s. But yeah, I think you're right. Like, he really, compared to Dracula, the supporting players in this movie, I think, are a lot more nuanced than the supporting players in Dracula. And Clive is one of them. And of course, he comes back a few years later in Bride of Frankenstein, which we'll talk about as well. And, you know, he becomes more of a hero in that movie too. You know, there's not as much balance as there is in this. But yeah, I think it's a solid performance. And now let's talk about the character of Elizabeth, played by Mae Clark. Also, compared to Helen Chandler, who was in Dracula, she's Meryl Streep. Helen Chandler, who chewed more scenery than Lugosi.
And that's really saying something.
But yeah, I really like her. And what's interesting is a bit of trivia. James Whale's the one who fought for Mae Clark, because she was in a movie with him called Waterloo Bridge a year before. But Universal wanted to try out a new girl that they had under contract named Betty Davis. And
Can you imagine Betty Davis in this part? I cannot.
Yeah. And they decided not to, and they let her go, and she went over to Warner Brothers, and the rest is history. But just think how history would have been different had Betty Davis played Elizabeth in Frankenstein.
I can't make that work in my head.
but no, Mae Clark had a very good year in 1931, because she's Elizabeth in this movie, and then she's the leading lady in The Public Enemy with James Cagney. Mm. Gets a grapefruit shoved in her face. So there's,
it's a living.
but yeah, I think she's pretty independent. I think, you know, there's a couple of scenes, as you mentioned before, her getting locked in the bedroom isn't fun, but no, she's really, really interested, and she wants to be a part of Henry's work, and she doesn't like that he's shutting her out. And I just think it's more interesting. She's got more romantic chemistry with Victor than she does.
Yeah, she really, really does.
I think that's part of the fun of the movie too. But yeah, I think she's very likable, Allison.
Oh, I agree. I don't really have any issues with her performance. Really, my big thing is the whole, like, we've locked her in a room.
Yeah.
She's hysterical. Lock her up. There's a monster. He's somewhere in here. We're going to lock her in a room. That's a good idea. Great, great choice, Henry. And nobody was like, hey, hold on. How about we don't lock up the bride? No, Victor's right there. Like, nobody goes, Henry, can we maybe not imprison our lover? What a weird choice. It's one but that
to I me was, that feels like the first time in a movie it's that yelling at the screen moment where you're like, no, don't do that.
Don't go in there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That becomes the horror trope, you know? And I think this is one of the first movies. I don't think you even see that as much in Dracula, you know?
Yeah. So
you never yell, don't go in there, because they're armed. They're ready to kill a vampire. But
right. You
know, this one, it's like,
this is the stupidest
irony.
Thing you could do.
Absolutely. and we know that, you know, the characters in hindsight, it's like, boy, that was a dumb move. But that is like, you know, that perpetuates today into, there's that great series of Geico commercials where the people run around the woods and they're like, why can't we get
quick,
in the running car?
Behind the chainsaw.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like, that's this, that's, you know, let's lock her in a room. Yeah. Great idea.
I did appreciate that she is like, I'm worried about Henry. And she is the one who's going out and being sensible. You know, at the wedding, she's the one going, hey, I have a bad feeling about this day.
She does.
Something is going to happen. And she kicks those bridesmaids out and they gave her the stink eye. Ooh, they were like, I'm taking my hat and I'm leaving. and she looks fabulous doing it. That cathedral veil is absolutely stunning. She's like one of the sensible characters. And I appreciated that, because that was not often the case in these type of movies. Usually it's silly, flighty women. And she's kind of a grounding character, like, hold on, let's come back to reality.
Yes. She is. And I think part of it, because this is 31, and so this is pre-code.
Right.
And so women were a little more independent in the pre-code era. And then once the code comes in the mid-30s,
silly,
you start
flighty.
Making them, you know, more domestic and silly, flighty. Yeah. And they're a little more independent between, you know, the late 20s and like 34 or 35. So we're in that that sweet spot right now. But yeah, a really, really solid performance. And then, you know, those are the three main characters. Let's talk about, we can talk a little more quickly about some of the supporting characters, but Edward Van Sloan, who plays Dr. Waldman, who also does the intro at the beginning, you know, he had just played Van Helsing in Dracula. And, you know, you and I think, Eric, I talked last year about how such Van Helsing is so passive. His portrayal is so passive in that version of Dracula. And here he's a little more menacing. And so it's fun to see that side of him. And, of course, he doesn't have a fun ending. But I think he kind of asked for it.
Yeah, because he's got some of the same hubris that Dr. Frankenstein has. He decides that he's going to be the one to end the monster's life, and that doesn't work out great for him. But sort of the same thing. I think he's poking around and trying to get to the scientific aspect of it, and it kind of ignores the humanity portion of it, and it bites him in the end. The performance is fine. He comes across as intellectual and, yeah, has a little more to do than Van Helsing and Dracula. But, yeah, he turns in a good one.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good. Yeah. There's not, you know, it's not a standout performance, but it's good.
Yeah, and I also have to call out Dwight Fry. I forgot his name was Fritz in this and not Igor, because we just think of it.
Same.
Bela Lugosi plays Igor a few years later in Son of Frankenstein. But so good. I mean, he steals the movie in Dracula as Renfield, and he almost steals the movie in this, because he just has that perfect look, and he's so great. And I just, you know, and of course he's asking for it too at the end, because he's torturing this monster. it's like he walks into the lion's den and just, you know, brings red meat with him.
Yeah, he's kind of the red meat himself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But another great physical performance.
I mean, oh yeah.
And if you didn't know that was the same actor, if you saw Renfield and you saw Fritz, you may not know, because even though they're both kind of these toadying characters, the way he carries himself in Dracula versus Frankenstein is very different, you know, and he shimmies up things to climb up and cut dead bodies down, but very good physical performance here too.
Yeah, I was impressed with all of the shimmying up of things, and they've got that little like climbing rope up to the roof, and he just comes flying down that thing.
He would have played a great Quasimodo if they had done like a Hunchback of Notre Dame around this time.
Yeah,
he really would have. And then
he has a little moment on the steps that just made me laugh out loud. He like hitches his pants up in a really weird way. He's got that teeny tiny stick. I was like, I don't know if that was intended to be funny, but it really made me chuckle.
But I remember that shot, and the great thing is that he's descending the steps, and it's lit from the bottom.
Yeah, like, the lighting's so good.
They didn't ignore any of that. When you say cinematography is great in this, that's one of those examples.
Yes.
And his physicality when he's stealing the brain, and when you know, the skeleton spooks him and everything, it's great. And you see where Marty Feldman stole from that, and young Frank, I forgot how much of like just a shot for shot that little Abbey Normal scene is, but it's great. And yeah, he's just fantastic. And then also I do like, you know, this time around, I like John Bowles as Victor. I think he's very likable. He's not, you know, a blowhard like, you know, normally a character like that would be in these kinds of movies. He's pretty likable and sympathetic, and as I mentioned before, has better romantic chemistry with Elizabeth than Henry does.
Yeah, he does come off as actually concerned friend.
Yeah. Yeah, although I have to say my favorite this time around was though Frederick Carr as Baron Frankenstein. I think he's hysterical.
Yes.
When he's trying to knock on the door of the laboratory and he's just scraping it.
And the whole great grandmother's wine thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That like recurring bit, or like where he's like, give the servants the champagne. They won't appreciate this. And the servants are like, we'll take it.
I could listen to him talk all day. Oh, yeah. There's just something about that, that sort of regal accent that he, and it feels kind of put on, but it's still, it's kind of funny. I could just listen to that all day.
Oh, yeah. And when he gives all the villagers, what do they say? You know, you put two beers in them.
He said they'll all be fighting again tomorrow.
They'll all be fighting again tomorrow.
Yeah, and I enjoyed him.
And he gets the last line in the movie. He gets the last shot.
Mm-hmm.
That's great, yeah. But yeah, it's a really, like I said, compared to Dracula, I felt like the cast were all pretty well nice standouts this time around. They all sort of contribute well. Let's transition though. Let's go to favorite scenes. There's really some big set pieces in this movie. Eric, I'll start with you.
And I want to talk about one of those big set pieces, but we'll circle back around to that. I'm sure we've got to talk about Little Maria.
Yes.
You know, the scene that sort of shows the childlike, thought pattern of the monster, and that maybe he's got some ability to be redeemed, but just doesn't understand how the world works. I totally forgot about this scene. And I've seen this movie a couple of different times. And the minute they cut to the farm where Maria's told to stay there while her father goes out, this pit formed in my stomach, and I was like, oh, this is coming up again. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think even through the first time watching this, you know, when the dad goes away, and especially as a parent, I know, Allison, you're probably like, don't go away. There's a monster
don't
on the loose.
Don't leave the kid. It's a terrible idea. Right? Yeah. Never leave your child unattended like that next to a body of water.
Yes. But it's cute. She treats him so sweetly. Yeah. And that little actress does a phenomenal job in that scene. Mm-hmm. And Boris Karloff's giving it all he's got, too. You know.
Oh, yeah. Actually, my two-year-old son was watching it with us, half watching, half doing other things, because he's two. But in that scene, he did stop and watch. And like when she gives him the flowers, my son went, that was nice. He was like, oh, that's nice. And then he said, what's going to happen? So it's really cute. But yeah, that child, like, it really captures that. Even the two-year-old was following what was happening.
Oh, yeah.
Because he did it. Yeah, it shows you that he could, maybe if there had been an adult present, that could have been a big turning point for him. But because he was abandoned the way he was abandoned.
Yeah, and instead of jabbing torches at him, maybe if they had gotten some flowers out, you know, things at the castle would have gone a lot differently too.
And Karloff did not want to shoot that scene. He told James Whale, and James Whale said, no, this is the one scene we have to have. This is the scene that makes this a horror movie. And apparently
it get cut in a bunch of places.
It did. Well, and had this been filmed, you know, a few years later, this being pre-code, if this during the code, this would not have been allowed, probably.
Never.
And it got cut for a long time. That and then Henry Frankenstein's line of "I know what it's like to be God." Those two things got cut by the Catholic Legion of Decency, and so yeah, that scene would not have happened. But an interesting story: the little actress Marilyn Harris. They shot it the first time and she didn't sink. The water was too shallow and she just kind of swam to the top or whatever. And so a Whale said, oh, we got to shoot this one more time and throw her out a little deeper. And so he went to her and he said, I will give you anything you want. He said, you know, let's just shoot this one more time. And she said she wanted a dozen hard boiled eggs because her mom always had her on a diet and she couldn't eat anything. And so they said they did the scene. It was perfect. And James Whale brought her 2 dozen hard boiled eggs the next day.
If that's not the most perfect little kid answer.
Right.
Just want eggs.
Yep.
Anything in the world you want. 12 eggs, please.
But yeah, that's a legendary scene. I mean, and there was also a funny commercial in the 90s, I think, that poked fun at
that. I remember that one.
I think it was for a phone company or something like that. I forget something what it was. Like yeah, something like that. But yeah, so that's a legendary scene. Allison, do you have a favorite?
Oh, I think that the bringing to life the monster is it for me. With all the funky gadgets and all the things arcing in the background, and he's like, sit down, you'll watch, I'm not crazy, you'll watch. I loved it. It's so good. It's so entrancing to just watch this crazy thing go down.
And those effects still work 89 years later.
Yeah.
Practical effects, you know, there's nothing. And
it really can't be practical effects.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Yeah. And let's see, the set designer's name was Kenneth Strickfaden, and he designed, and he used an actual Tesla coil actually from Tesla, and he designed all the, and you know, and there was no blueprint for this kind of stuff. He just
made it up.
It just came from his mind, and it looks
real fantastic. Mad scientist.
And every mad scientist film, every Frankenstein film uses electricity like this, and that whole scene is just filmed brilliant. I mean, all the different cuts and the Dutch angles and the, you know, and the little shots of electricity and everything.
And the sound.
Yeah. It's perfect. And we haven't talked about this yet, but like Dracula, this does not have a music score.
Right.
Which, you know, would change with some of these monster movies which would make them seem like different movies down the line, but it's just sound effects. And you know, just the sound effects of the lightning storm and the machines going and everything. It's a beautiful scene, even 89 years later. Yeah.
And the thing I'm curious about too is because they pull back on that scene after the monster has been awakened, and that looks like they either cut the side off of a castle or they built a giant set piece for that thing. And my guess is that they built it, given the budget that they had. Yeah,
I'm sure they built it. Yeah. Based on, I think Dracula helped pay for the Frankenstein castle.
Yeah, exactly.
but yeah, that's such a good scene. I also love the opening after the credits, you know, the whole graveyard scene, because it's everything is shot on an angle. Nothing is like straight. Mm-hmm. And it's so eerie. And then you get to the close up of Fritz and him, you know, from behind the fence. It's so eerie. And then I love, there's such symbolism, like when they're digging, because like there's one moment where Henry, you know, because there's that statue of the Grim Reaper behind him, and he throws dirt on it. It's like, you know, because he's cheating death, he's throwing dirt in the Grim Reaper's face. Yeah. It's I love that whole section. And then the finale, of course, you know, I think all I kept thinking that time is, of course, this is where Howard Ashman got the idea for Kill the Beast, because
of course,
because he has because they're all saying light your torch. I'm like, there's
light
even some torches. Of the lyrics in there.
Yeah.
but yeah, and of course that whole, you know, that whole setting the windmill on fire, it still works today. You can tell a little bit that they're using some kind of projection, things like that. But like even, and you can tell it's a dummy that's falling onto the windmill or whatever, but it still works.
It still works.
And your heart breaks for the monster when he realizes that, you know, he's going to be burned alive, which, of course, if you've seen The Bride of Frankenstein, you know he doesn't. But, you know, the people at that time didn't know that. But Karloff's performance in that, because you can tell that he kind of feels torn, too. He doesn't really want to hurt this guy, but this is what they've turned me into.
Yeah.
Yep. Can tell he read the source material.
any other scenes that stand out to you?
I mean, I think the filming of all of the wedding scenes is really, really well done too. I mean, you've got now a cast of a couple hundred and a music. You don't have a score with this film, so you've got music going on that's being filmed. You know, they wouldn't have separated the sound there from the video like they would on something these days. So that's a technical achievement too, to have all those extras and have it look good. And then I especially love the tracking shot then of the father carrying his now dead daughter in. It just really kind of resonates. Oh. And you see the crowd change as he walks by, and it's really powerful.
Yeah, you see him stand up and the attitude change when they see that he is carrying his child through.
Yeah.
And that actor, he gives a really good performance in that scene. Well done. And not over the top. But yeah, just like as you mentioned, every little scene in this, like, nothing is throwaway. It all sort of blends together. They inject comedy when they need to with the Baron Frankenstein character, and it all just works, I think. Is there anything that doesn't work for you?
Well, I was going to say they can't throw anything away, because ending runtime is this thing is something like an
minutes,
hour and 10 minutes.
It's tight.
Which is great. You know, it's like, here, we're going to deliver our message and we're going to do it effectively and efficiently.
Yeah.
There's
really no fat to trim.
No. And that's really, really works for this one.
Yeah. If you're wanting to marathon these monster movies, you know, you can watch three in an afternoon because they're all only a little over an hour.
Yeah.
So it's really, really great. Really good use of time. Anything at all that doesn't work for you?
I mean, I think Allison brought it up. There's a little bit of the, it's the 1930s, the men are the scientists and the heroes, and the women are there to be married. And I think they manage that though pretty well by, like you said, Allison, having the lead actress take the initiative to say, I'm going to go and talk to Henry. I keep wanting to call him Victor.
Right.
Too.
They owe that.
That's not Victor. Victor's the other guy.
Right. And it's great. They just switch their names, you know, Victor in the movie is Henry in the book.
Yeah.
That character, he doesn't do a whole lot. They maybe could have dropped that, but like you said, Brandon, he's got chemistry there. So, he doesn't do a whole lot in the film, but going back to how the female characters are treated, I got to think that some of that is from the source material and the fact that it was written by a woman too.
Yeah.
I think there's some pride in that, and it is sort of celebrated subtly in this movie. Mm-hmm.
What got me when I looked at the credits was all of the different writers, because it's like you've got someone who wrote the script, but then it's like based on the play, based on the original source material, based on the
it had already had several iterations on stage at this point. Mm-hmm. So in some reading I was doing, they did pull a few things specifically from stage adaptations, like the scene of the creation of the monster is not in the book.
Yeah,
it takes place like in his dorm room or something like that.
Well, and she just kind of glosses past that. There's not a big moment. It's just like, oh, hey, I've got this dude now.
And the character of Fritz, he was introduced in the stage play, and so they took that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't think there's really much that doesn't work for me in this. Like I said, there's not really any fat to trim. They kept it pretty on course. It's 1931, but it's pre-code 1931. So
yeah. Well, I'm looking right now. This movie had a budget. Its budget was $262,000, and the box office it made $12 million. In the Great Depression.
In the Great Depression.
Yeah, and it opened at the Mayfair Theater in New York City on December 4th. So happy holidays, everybody. But it grossed $53,000 in the first week.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's pretty good. But yeah, it's, let's see what the New York Times film critic had to say. He gave the film a positive review. He said the film aroused so much excitement at the Mayfair yesterday that many in the audience laughed to cover their true feeling. There's no denying that it's far and away the most effective thing of its kind. Beside it, Dracula's tame. And incidentally, Dracula was produced by the same studio. So, a great release, and then unfortunately it wasn't nominated for any Oscars, which kind of surprises me. But and you know, 31 was a different time, but taking a look at, let's see, the American Film Institute in 1998, it was 87th on the 100 Years, 100 Movies list. And then It's Alive, It's Alive was the 49th greatest movie quote of all time. And then it was number 56 on the 100 Years, 100 Thrills of the most heart-pounding movies of all time. So it's up there. And then also it ranked number 27 on Bravo's 100 Scariest Movies of All Time. So it's, yeah, it's got a good pedigree. And like you said, it still works 89 years later. And 5 years later, we spawned a sequel, Bride of Frankenstein, which actually I think a lot of people consider even a better movie than what this one is. And I think Bride of Frankenstein might feel more like an actual horror movie than what this movie does. And by that time, you're using a score, and you know, and although I read Karloff was not a fan of Bride of Frankenstein because he never thought the monster should have talked, and he learns to talk in Bride of Frankenstein. But
come on, source material.
Yeah.
He's reading Paradise Lost.
Yeah, and then Karloff only played the monster one more time in 1939 in Son of Frankenstein. And then after that, Lugosi played him, Lon Chaney played him, and then he's played by Glenn Strange for the rest of the time. And we'll talk about Glenn Strange's performance as Frankenstein later this month. But yeah, I mean, just spawned so much. And then, you know, because of Dracula and Frankenstein, we got The Invisible Man, The Mummy, Creature from the Black Lagoon, Phantom of the Opera. It all happened because of those two movies. And I'm sure each October we'll talk about one of them. So.
Yeah, indeed.
Yes.
So yeah. So as we close, Eric, final thoughts on Frankenstein.
Yeah. It's if you read the book in high school or college, like we all did, it's way different. But at the same time, it's the Frankenstein that you know, when you read the book, you're probably like, where's the bolts? Where's the flathead? Here's where it started. Yeah. And Dracula was the first, but this is probably the better movie of the two, you know, and I called this one 1B, but as I'm sitting here thinking, I'm like, I enjoyed this probably more than watching Dracula.
Dracula rests on Lugosi's performance, whereas Frankenstein, indeed, I think, is a bigger package.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So it's really worth watching because of that.
Yeah, Allison?
Yeah, if you have never taken the time to sit, and it's not very much time, to sit and watch this, you should definitely carve out an hour, because it's cool. If for no other reason, then it's really cool to see where all these different tropes, all these cultural ideas about this character, about what a horror story looks like on film, it's really cool to see them play out for the first time. Mm-hmm. Like Eric was saying, if you're going into this like, I read this book, that's not going to be the experience that you have. But coming into it as like, this is our cultural understanding of what Frankenstein is, and just enjoying it for what it is, and have a nice hour and 7 minutes. It's a beautifully filmed movie. The acting is fantastic from the leads, and particularly Karloff. Like, you should watch it. If you haven't watched it, do it. Spooky season. What are you waiting for?
Yeah, it really, really does make me happy that a movie made 89 years ago still holds up. It proves that good art can, that movies are art, you know, that, you know, like a good painting centuries later, movies can still speak to us a century later. So these movies are going to last, and they're going to still speak to us, and they're still going to spook us and scare us. Maybe not in the same way they did for audiences in 31, because, you know, this was kind of new territory then. And we've become more desensitized to things like this, but yeah, and just because of Karloff's performance alone, even though we've said this is a, James Whale was an artist, and you know, through, you know, his cinematography, and I didn't mention actually the cinematographer in this movie is Arthur Edison, who did the cinematography for The Maltese Falcon and a lot of great film noirs, so you can see where that kind of started from as well. So Frankenstein was the beginning of a lot of things. So yeah, just fantastic. And so as you watch Frankenstein this October, we're not going away yet for the month. We'll be back for MonsterCast later this month. And we're going to revisit the Frankenstein monster again. And actually, we're going to also see Bela Lugosi as Dracula again. And for the first time, we'll be talking about Lon Chaney as the Wolfman, because we're talking about Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein later this month. So that's going to be a crazy, crazy discussion.
I can't wait. I'm so excited.
If you thought Road to Morocco was crazy, this is a little zanier.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
You don't get Bing Crosby ballads in this movie. It's just straight up. So I'm looking forward to that. I think you two are too, aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So once again, you know, classics just keeps moving on. Eric, I think you and I, we had great response to that interview we did with Todd Fisher that was released a couple weeks ago. And, man, he was very generous with his time. And so we really thank him for being on with us. And, you know, even though we wish we were not in the situation we're in right now, I think classics has only gotten better, you know, during these last few months.
Oh, yeah, I concur. It's a great time to go rediscover these old movies and see what they can tell us today as the world is so different.
Yeah. Yeah. So lots more to come, lots more fun to come. And we will close out now. Just a reminder, Front Row Classics does have our own feed. So for all of you who subscribe to different podcasts, we're on Amazon Podcasts, Spotify, everywhere. And we're going to be doing feed-only episodes. And so this Abbott and Costello episode we're doing is a feed-only episode. So if you want to hear that, subscribe to our feed-only. We're still part of the Front Row Network umbrella, but we're all of our shows, we're all expanding. And so if you want to hear that, and Road to Morocco, please subscribe to our feed only. And there's more goodies coming, you know, before the end of 2020. So once again, you know, we thank you, and we'll keep doing what we're doing. And for Front Row Classics, I'm Brandon.
I'm Eric.
I'm Allison.
And we will see you in the front row.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to this episode, a proud member of the Front Row Network of shows on NPR Illinois. For the past 5 years, we've been providing hours of content every month, and now we've created the chance for all of you to get even more content. We've officially launched our Patreon page to give you the chance to support our work. There are 4 separate levels, and each come with their own amazing bonus perks, including exclusive episodes, full movie commentary tracks, and even the ability to choose what episodes we do and be on the with us. To show your support, simply go to www.patreon.com/frontrownetwork. That's patreon.com/frontrownetwork. Thank you again, and as always, we'll see you in the front row.